Chapter 10. At 7 bells in the forenoon watch, the surprise under topsails alone heaved to. The officers began to assemble on the quarterdeck, the midshipmen on the gangway, all carrying their quadrants or sextants, for the sun was approaching the meridian, and they were to take his altitude at the moment he crossed it, thereby finding just how far south of the equator they were at noon. To the landsman, to the mere superficial observer, this might have seemed a work of supererogation, since clear on her larboard bow rose the headland of Punta Angeles, the western extremity of Valparaiso Bay, whose position had been laid down with the utmost accuracy time out of mind, while in the brilliantly clear air miles of the great Cordillera could be seen, the peak of Aconcagua, a perfect compass bearing to the northeast. But as far as Jack Aubrey was concerned, this was neither here nor there. He liked to run a man of war, as men of war had always been run, with the ship's day beginning at noon. And this was a particularly important day, the last of the month, and the first on which he could hope to find Stephen Maturin in Valparaiso. He therefore wished nothing to be done that might break the established pattern or bring ill luck. It was true that a few years ago some wild enthusiast, a Whiggish civilian, no doubt, had decreed that day should start at midnight. But Jack, though a scientific, forward-looking officer, agreed with many of his fellow captains in giving this foolish innovation no countenance whatsoever. Besides, it had taken him years to persuade Stephen that nautical days really did start at noon, and he did not want his imperfect conviction to be shaken in any way at all. Then again, once this last day of the month had in fact begun, he meant to carry out some physical measurements for his friend the polymath Alexander Humboldt, in whose penguin-filled cold northern current the ship was now swimming. Silence fore and aft, anxious peering through many an eyepiece. Jack brought his own sun down 3 times to the fine, firm horizon, and on the third it was a trifle below the second which had been the true altitude. He noted the angle, and turning he found Tom Pullings, who in this anomalous ship played many parts as well as that of first lieutenant, standing there bareheaded beside him. "Noon and 33 degrees south, sir, if you please," said Tom.
"Very good, Captain Pullings," replied Jack. "Make it 12.
Pullings turned to Norton, the mate of the watch, and said, "Make it 12, in a strong, hieratic voice. Norton, with equal gravity, hailed the quartermaster not 3 feet away. "Strike 8 bells and turn the glass." The 4 double strokes rang out, and with the last still in the air, Pullings, directing his words to the boatswain, roared, "Pipe to dinner!" The lions at the Tower of London made a prodigious and indeed a shocking din on being fed, but theirs was a kittenish mewling compared with that of the surprise. Besides, the lions were rarely provided with mess kids upon which the seamen beat with such zeal, this being Thursday, a salt pork day, and one upon which an extraordinary plum duff was to be served out in honour of the birthday of Lord Melville, the brother of Captain Aubrey's particular friend Heneage Dundas, and First Lord of the Admiralty at the time of Jack's reinstatement. The roaring was so usual that Jack barely noticed it. But the ensuing quietness did strike his mind. The surprise was not one of those discontented, spit-and-polish ships in which men were not allowed to speak on duty, for not only would this have been abhorrent to Jack Aubrey's feelings and dead contrary to his idea of command,
"A happy ship is your only right hard-fighting ship,"
but with such a ship's company it would not have answered for a moment, and except at times of strong activity there was always a steady, low hum of talk on deck. At present the temporary silence made the almost deserted deck seem still more empty, and Jack, addressing Adams, his clerk and factotum in the intellectual line, lowered his voice.
"Mr. Adams," he said, "when we have taken the temperatures and the salinity, we might try a sounding. With the 2 headlands we have a capital triangle, and I should like to know what the bottom is like at this point, if our line can reach it. Once that is done, we will take the ship a little farther in, and you can carry on in the cutter, just as though you were calling for mail or the like. I will give you the addresses where the doctor may be found, and if he is at either, you will bring him off directly. But with the utmost discretion, Mr. Adams. The utmost discretion, too, in asking the way. The utmost discretion is called for in this case. That is why I do not take her in and lie in the road or the port itself. Things may come to that or to some system of signalling. But how charming it would be if we could pluck him off the shore right away."
Lowering his voice still farther,
You will not repeat it, but there appears to be some question of a high-placed, very furious husband. Legal proceedings. Every kind of unpleasantness. You understand me?"
The quietness lasted throughout the scientific observations, and during the time the hands ate their dinner and drank their grog, a time during which Reed laid out the coils of deep-sea line at given intervals from the forecastle to the mizzen chains so that the men could let them go in succession. He had not retired to the midshipman's berth because he had been invited to dine in the cabin, invited to eat a much better dinner than he could hope to find in the berth, but to eat it more than 2 hours later than his usual time. And now, by way of distracting his ravenous, ever-increasing hunger, he indulged in capers unworthy of his rank or age, such as thumping the deep-sea lead against the frigate's side. The rhythmic noise broke in on Jack's calculations, and he called out,
"Mr. Reed! Mr. Reed there! Pray attend to your duty!"
His duty materialized in the next 2 minutes, when the afternoon watch came on deck and those hands who had been told off for the sounding took up their stations, each with a coil of the stout, water-laid line in his hand. Reed walked out on the larboard cathead, swinging the 28-pound lead in his one hand, watched with infinite anxiety by the seamen lining the side, dropped it into the water, calling, "Lead's away!" and walked back without a stumble. From forward aft, each man holding 20 fathoms in his hand sang out,
"Watch there! Watch!"
as he let the last coils go. Each of the 10 repeated the call, except for the last, in the mizzen chains, who held the fag end tight, no coils left at all, looked up at Reed, smiled, and shook his head.
"No bottom with this line, sir."
Reed crossed the quarterdeck, took off his hat, reported to Captain Aubrey,
"No bottom with this line, sir."
And seeing that Jack was no longer vexed with him, he went on,
"Oh, sir, I do wish you would look out over the larboard beam. There is as odd a craft as you can possibly imagine, a balsa, I think, sailing in the strangest way. It had been brought by the lee 3 times in the last 5 minutes, and the poor soul seems to be entangled in his sheet. He is a brave fellow to come on, but he has no more notion of handling a boat than the doctor."
Jack glanced at the boat. He covered his poor eye and stared fixedly with the other before crying,
"Mr. Norton, jump into the top with this glass. Look at that balsa with a purple sail and tell me what you see. Mr. Wilkins, let the red cutter be lowered down at once."
"On deck there,"
hailed Norton, his voice squeaking with emotion.
"On deck, sir. It is the doctor. He is overboard. No, he is back again. I believe his tiller has come unshipped."
The balsa, though wildly overloaded, was by definition unsinkable, and they brought him aboard to the heartiest cheers, helped him up the side with so zealous a welcome that he would have been pitched into the waist if Jack had not clasped him with both hands.
"Welcome aboard, Doctor!"
he cried, and the ship's company called out,
"Welcome aboard!
Aye, aye! Hear him! Welcome aboard! Huzzay! Huzzay!"
in defiance of all good order and discipline. As soon as he was in the cabin, and even while Killick and Padine were taking away his wet clothes and bringing dry, even while a pot of coffee was being brewed, Stephen examined Jack Aubrey's wounds.
The leg he passed, an ugly scar, no more, and the eye he gazed at without much comment, only saying that he would need a better light. Then, as they sat down to their fragrant cup, he went on, "Before I ask you how the ship sails along, how you have done and how all our people are, will I tell you why I came out to meet you in this precipitate, and I might almost say temerarious, manner?"
"If you please."
"I had reasons for not wishing to call any official attention to the surprise, but the chief cause for my haste was that I have some information that you might wish to act upon without the loss of a minute."
"Oh, indeed!"
cried Jack, his good eye lighting with its old predatory gleam.
"As I was leaving Peru because of the unjustified suspicions of a military man who misunderstood my examination of his wife, a deeply stupid but very powerful and bloody-minded military man..."
This was an explanation for some of Stephen's more bizarre movements that both of them understood perfectly. It was calculated, and very well calculated, to satisfy the minds of the seamen, who for a great while had looked upon the doctor's licentious capers ashore with an indulgent comprehension.
"A confidential friend came to see me by night, and knowing that I belonged to a British privateer, he gave me an account of 3 American China ships sailing in company from Boston. This document he gave me as a parting present, together with details of their insurance, their ports of call, and their estimated progress, in the hope that we might be able to intercept them. At that time, and for some hundreds of miles after, I paid no great attention to the matter, knowing the uncertainty of sea voyages, and indeed of my own, by land. Yet no sooner had I reached Valparaiso than I received word from my friend's correspondent in the Argentine. The ships had cleared from Buenos Aires on Candlemas Day. They meant to traverse the Straits Lemaire and to carry on, skirting south of Diego Ramirez by the end of the present month, and then heading northeast for Canton. I looked at the Abbot's map, and it occurred to me that by spreading every sail and straining every nerve we might get there in time.
"So we might,"
said Jack, after a moment's calculation, and he left the cabin. Returning, he cried,
"Oh, Stephen, what are we to do with the balsa and all those innumerable boxes, chests, and vile bundles that fill it to what would be the gunwale of a Christian boat?"
"Pray let them be brought aboard with the utmost care. As for the boat itself, let it be tossed off with a round turn, if you please, the cantankerous beast, though it is the clear loss of 0.5 crown and 18 pence for the sail, almost new. It came from the same yard and the same model as that which goes out on Thursdays for the monastery's fish, and the abbot assured me that one had but to pull a given rope, the escota, towards the back, to make it go faster. But this was not the case, though possibly I may have pulled the wrong rope. There were so many boxes on the floor. Indeed, there was so little room for me that I almost fell into the sea at times."
"Could you not have tossed the worst overboard?"
"The kind almoner had tied them down so tight, and the knots were wet, and in any case the worst, which sat upon three several ropes, held my grebe, my flightless Titicaca grebe. You would never have expected me to throw away a flightless grebe for all love. But, however, the monks had promised to pray for me, and with no more than moderate skill, I survived." Killick's insistent cough could be heard at the door. Then his knock.
"Which your guests have arrived, sir?"
he said. But his severity turned to an affectionate, gap-toothed leer as his eyes wandered to gaze upon Dr. Maturin.
"Could you possibly manage dinner, Stephen?" asked Jack.
"Any dinner at all," said Stephen, with great conviction. He was fresh from a monastery, unusually ascetic at all times, and now deep in a penitential fast. And in an undertone he added, "Even one of those infernal cavies." Dinner wound on from fresh anchovies, still present in their countless millions, to steak of tunny, to a tolerable sea pie, and so to an expected but still heartily welcome spotted dog. Stephen ate in wolfish silence until the very end of the sea pie. Then, being among old friends eager to hear, he leant back, loosened his waistband, and told them something of his botanizing and naturalizing journey south from Lima to Arica, where he took ship for Valparaiso. "But to reach Arica," he said, "we had to cross a very high pass, the Huechopilan, at more than 16,000 feet. And there my friend and I, and alas, a llama, were caught in what in those parts they call a viento blanco, and we should have perished if my friend Eduardo had not found a little small shelter in the rock. Indeed, the poor llama did die, and I was mortally frostbitten."
"Was it very painful, doctor?"
asked Pullings, looking grave.
"Not at all, at all, until the feeling began to return. And even then the whole lesion was less severe than I had expected. At one time I thought to have lost my leg below the knee, but in the event it was no more than a couple of unimportant toes. For you are to consider," he observed, addressing his words to Reed, "that your foot bases its impulse and equilibrium on the great toe and the least. The loss of either is a sad state of affairs entirely, but with the two one does very well. The ostrich has but two the whole length of her life, and yet she outruns the wind."
"Certainly, sir," said Reed, bowing. "Yet though the leg was spared, I could not well travel, above all after I had removed the peccant members."
"How did you do that, sir?"
asked Reed, unwilling to hear, though eager to be told.
"Why, with a chisel, as soon as we came down to the village. They could not be left to mortify, with gangrene spreading, the grief and the sorrow, but for a while I was reduced to immobility, and that was where my noble friend Eduardo showed his magnanimity. He caused a framework to be made, fitting over a man's chest, fore and aft. Fore and aft," he repeated with a certain satisfaction, "and allowing me to be carried on his shoulders, or somewhat lower, sitting at my ease and facing backwards. They call it an Inca chair, and in this Inca chair I was carried over those terrible Inca bridges that span stupendous chasms, hanging bridges that sway, and I was always carried by fresh and powerful Indians recruited by my friend, an Indian himself, and a descendant of the Incas, too. He generally travelled by my chair, except when the path led along the rocky side of a precipice, which it did far, far too often, where there was no room for two abreast, and a great deal did he tell me about the ancient empire of Peru and the magnificence of its rulers. "Surely," he said, breaking off to listen to the run of the water along the ship's side, and the general voice of taut rigging, masts, blocks, sails and yards. "Surely we are going very fast." "About 8 knots, I believe, sir," said Pullings, filling Stephen's glass. "Pray tell us about the magnificence of Peru." "Well, if gold is magnificent, and sure there is something imperial about gold in the mass, then Eduardo's account of Huayna Capac, the great Inca, and his chain will please you. It was made when the birth of his son, Huasca, was to be celebrated in a ceremony at which the court went through the motions of a formal dance, joining hands, making a circle, and moving 2 steps forward, then 1 back, thus drawing closer and closer until they were at a proper distance for making their obeisance. The Inca, however, disapproved of this holding of hands. He thought it too familiar, quite improper, and he gave orders for a chain to be made, a chain which the dancers could hold, thus keeping their formation but avoiding direct physical contact which might lead to irregularities. Naturally, the chain was made of gold. The links were as thick as a man's wrist, the length twice that of the great square at Cuzco, which makes upwards of 700 feet, and its weight was such that 200 Indians could only just lift it from the ground.
"Oh," cried his listeners, who naturally enough included Killick and his mate Grimshaw.
And while their mouths were still rounded, young Weddell came in with Mr. Granger's compliments and duty to the captain, and might he set the weather stunsails. The breeze had veered half a point, and he reckoned they would stand.
"Oh, by all means, Mr. Weddell," cried Jack. "Let him crack on till all sneers again."
Just how it became known throughout the ship that the captain's chase had a beast in view, and that it was not only the joy of being homeward bound that caused him to spread so much canvas, to spend so much time on deck, taking every possible advantage of the wind and whipping jibs and staysails in and out, could not be clearly stated. Yet known it was, and no officer or master's mate ever had to emphasize, still less repeat, any order that might carry the barkie more briskly to the high south latitudes. Some of the knowledge derived from the obvious fact that the doctor, though incapable of telling a bark from a ship or a bowline from a midshipman's hitch, was not as simple as he looked. That, indeed, would have been difficult, and that he did not spend all his time on shore in bowsing up his jib or inspecting ladies in their shifts, but sometimes picked up valuable news. Yet this did not account for the 2 or 3 China ships out of Boston, or the south of Diego Ramirez that could so often be heard on the lower deck, together with the calculation that a steady 5 knots from noon to noon, day after day, would get them there with time and to spare, which could only come from deliberate eavesdropping or very close attention to all possible clues, such as the captain's poring over his charts of the desolate regions south of the Horn. Yet this eagerness for a prize, so natural in the crew of a man of war, was curiously coloured and accentuated by Stephen's account of the Inca's great chain, an account that had nothing whatsoever to do with Boston merchantmen launched 250 years later. It nevertheless suffused the whole ship's collective state of mind.
"How much do you suppose a tolerably stout Indian could lift?" asked Reed. "They are natives, you know," said Weddell. "And everyone knows that natives can raise prodigious great burdens, though not much above 5 feet tall."
"Say 200 weight, said Norton.
"That makes 400 hundredweight for 200 Indians, said Reed,
writing it on the slate used for his rough day's work,
"which is 20 tons, or 44,800 pounds, which is 716,800 ounces. What is gold worth an ounce?"
£3.17 10 halfpenny, said Norton. "That was what Mr. Adams reckoned when last prize money was shared out, and all hands agreed."
"3.17 10½ to be multiplied by 716,800, said Reed. "There ain't room enough for it on the slate, and anyhow they are avoirdupois ounces instead of troy. But whichever way you look at it, the answer is well over 2 millions of money." "Can you imagine 2 millions of money?"
Yes, they could. A deer park, bow windows, a pack of hounds, a private band in a genteel conservatory. And so could others, before the mast and abaft, and although no one was so simple as to confuse these two quite separate ideas, the hypothetical prizes far to the south tended to glow with an additional and quite charming lustre, in spite of the fact that almost every man aboard was already richer than he had ever been in his life from the earlier captures, and that neither the frigate's captain nor her surgeon really needed any more at all. "There is something profoundly discreditable about this delight in taking other men's property away from them by force," observed Stephen, tuning his long-neglected cello. "Taking it away openly, legally, and being praised, caressed, and even decorated for doing so. I quell, or attempt to quell, the feeling every time it rises in my bosom, which it does quite often."
"Pray pass the rosin,"
said Jack. And before dashing away into the allegro vivace of their boccherini, he added,
"I may see little of you in the morning. We shall spend much of our time exercising the great guns, but you will never forget that I am to be your guest for dinner in the gun-room, I am sure."
Nothing could have been less certain. Dr. Maturin had been so engrossed in the preliminary unpacking, sorting, registering, cleaning, and roughly preserving the collections that had come aboard from the Balsa that he was perfectly capable of forgetting all ordinary duties other than those of the sick berth and all social decencies.
"He is also capable of supposing that the ship's company is still much as he left it," reflected Jack,
and at the end of the movement he said,
"I believe you have not dined in the gun-room yet."
"I have not," said Stephen. "With the sick berth and my collections to sort, I have scarcely been on deck either, or asked half my shipmates how they do. You cannot readily conceive the fragility of an undressed bird's skin, my dear."
"Then perhaps I should tell you of some changes you will see. Veedle has left the ship and two of his nipper-dolling cousins, and he has been replaced in the gun-room by William Sadler, a thoroughgoing seaman. And then before the mast there was poor John Proby, who lost the number of his mess 2 days out of Callao."
"That I knew. He was in a sad decline, in spite of what little we could do for him in the way of bark and steel and linctus. But Fabian very kindly kept me one of his hands, recollecting my interest in the singular calcification of its sinews. Fabian is a most valuable assistant." Jack could still be made uneasy by remarks of this kind, and it was a little while before he went on.
"And you will not see Bulkley any more either."
"The facetious boatswain?"
"Just so. He'd also been a boatswain in the Navy, you know, and with the surprise being run man-of-war fashion, he slipped back more and more into his old service ways. You know the expression capybar, I dare say?"
"Certainly. I'm no new-fledged canvas climber, I believe. It is the topmost summit, the ultimate pinnacle of some towering mast."
"No doubt. But we commonly use it for that tendency in the boatswains of King's ships to steal all marine stores not immovably screwed down. I checked him once for a missing kedge in Anamooka, and again for a coil of 3-inch manila at Moahu, with God knows how many things in between. And he promised to reform. But in Callao he made off with several lengths of chain, a can-hook, and our lightning conductor. Our best Snow Harris lightning conductor. And when I told him of it, he had the provoking effrontery to defend his action on the grounds that everyone knew that metal attracts the flesh, and that a glass ball at the masthead was the only true safeguard. And as for the other things, they were quite worn out."
Discussing the perils of the sea in general, and of lightning in particular, came very near to talking shop, an act less criminal than sodomy, which carried the death sentence, but not very much so, and the gunroom cast some nervous looks at their guest, the captain, a stickler for naval etiquette. But since it was clear both from his thoroughly amiable expression and his own anecdotes that lightning was this side of the barrier between right and wrong, the subject occupied the company for the not inconsiderable time they took to eat a noble turtle and empty the dish. The gunroom was less crowded now that the merchants and ransomers had left, and it was more nearly naval. Jack, Stephen, and Tom Pullings were in fact serving officers. Adams had walked the quarterdeck for most of his active life. Wilkins had served in half a dozen King's ships as midshipman or master's mate, and Granger, together with his brother-in-law Sadler, had taken on the local colour in the most natural way. The conversation, therefore, had a greater freedom, all the more so since the frigate was homeward bound.
"This very ship was struck by a levin flash off Penedo in the Brazils," observed Stephen, "and she lost the mast, the spar, the thing in front, the bowsprout. I was asleep at the time, and for a moment I thought we were in the midst of a fleet action, the noise was so great."
"Was there anyone killed, Doctor?" asked Granger.
"There was not."
"Ah," said William Sadler,
My cousin Jackson was carpenter's crew in the Diligent when she was struck by forked lightning near the island of a Thursday, which three hands were killed in the maintop, and he said their bodies stayed warm till Sunday after church, when they were obliged to be put over the side.
The Repulse was laying off Spain in the year 10, said Pullings. It was a Thursday too, and all hands had washed clothes. Towards evening clouds began to gather thick, and the watch below, afraid their laundry would be rained upon when the things were nearly dry, jumped aloft to take it in. There was a single flash, and seven dropped down dead on deck, while 13 more were horribly burnt.
When Prince William had the Pegasus, said Jack, a single stroke utterly destroyed her mainmast.
General considerations on lightning followed this, most frequent between the tropics, certain trees more liable to be struck than others, willows, ash, solitary oaks to be avoided, sultry, oppressive weather favourable, tolerably common in the temperate zone, unknown in Finland, Iceland, and Hudson's Bay, presumably even more unknown nearer to either pole, probably because of the northern lights. But these remarks, together with speculation on the nature of the electric fluid, were interrupted by the appearance of a roast-sucking pig, borne in on a splendid Peruvian silver dish, the rescued merchants present to the surprise, and sat down according to custom before Dr. Maturin, whose skill as a carver was intimately known to many of those present. The talk grew more cheerful. Pigs at home, how best dressed. Pigs wild, on a remote island in the South China Sea, that had nourished Captain Aubrey and his people for a great while. A little tame black sow at Pulling's father's farm on the edge of the New Forest that would find you a basket of trubs, or truffles as some called them, in a morning, winking and grinning at you with each trub, never eating a single one herself. By the time they reached the port, the conversation was more cheerful still, the words homeward bound recurring very often, with conjectures about the delightful changes to be seen in children, gardens, shrubberies, and the like.
"My grandfather," said Granger, "was sailmaker's mate in the Centurion when Commodore Anson took the Acapulco galleon in 43. He had his share of the 1,313,842 pieces of eight they found in her, a figure I always remember, and that made him right glad, as you may well suppose. But when he learnt that now they were to steer for home, he used to say it made him happier still."
"Ha, ha!" cried Wilkins, somewhat flushed with his wine. "Homeward bound is very well, but homeward bound with a pocketful of prize money is better still. Huzzay for the horn!"
There was a good deal of cheerful noise at this, and more chuckling among the mess attendants than was either right or decent, but Jack, recovering his gravity, shook his head, saying,
"Come, gentlemen, do not let us tempt fate. Do not let us say anything presumptuous that may prove unlucky. We must not sell the bear's skin before we have locked the stable door, and locked it with a double turn."
"Very true," cried Pullings and Granger. "Very true. Hear him."
"For my part," Jack went on, "I shall not repine if we meet nothing off the Horn. We have to pass that way in any case, and if our hurry makes us no richer, why, it carries us home the sooner. I long to see my new plantations."
"I do not like the prospect of this Horn," said Stephen in a low voice, "or all this haste to reach it. This is in every way a most exceptional year. Cranes have been seen flying north over Lima, and the weather down there is sure to be more disagreeable than ever."
"But you have wonderful sea legs, Doctor," said Adams, "and if we crack on, we may reach the height of the Horn at a capital time for the passage. Barely a ripple, I have been told, with picnics on the island itself."
"It is my collection I am thinking of," said Stephen. "Whatever you may say, the sea around the Horn is bound to be damp, whereas my collections come from one of the driest parts of the whole terraneous globe. They need very careful attention, acres of oiled silk, weeks of calm, patient care in describing, figuring, packing.
Once they are tumbled and tossed unprepared on the jellied billows, all is lost. Their pristine glory is gone forever."
"Well, Doctor," said Jack, "some weeks I think I can promise you. Your cranes may have lost their heads, but the trades, or rather the anti-trades, have kept theirs, and they are blowing as sweetly as ever our best friends could wish."
The promised weeks they had, weeks of pure sailing, with the Surprise slanting across the prevailing wind and often logging 200 sea miles between one noon observation and the next. Weeks of close, satisfying work for Stephen, who was delighted with Fabian's exact and beautiful watercolours of the many specimens still in their full glory. weeks of ardent sailoring for Jack, with evenings full of music, fresh fish over the side, and penguins in constant attendance. And when at last the anti-trades faltered and left them, within a day the even more favourable westerlies took over. Those were idyllic weeks, but how difficult it was to remember them, to call them vividly to mind as an experienced reality, a fortnight after the ship had sailed into the true Antarctic, and more than Antarctic stream, the haunt of the wandering albatross, mollymawks in all their variety, the great bone-breaking petrel, the stinkpot and the icebird, had sailed into that green water at 14 knots under topsails, forecourses and a jib, impelled by an almighty quartering wind. The change was not unexpected. Well before this ominous parallel, the frigate's people had been engaged in shifting, packing, and storing her light sails, and replacing them with much heavier cloth, with storm canvas trysails and the like for emergency. Many a watch had been spent in sending up preventer backstays, braces, shrouds, and stays, and in attending to new earrings, robbins, reef points, reef tackles for the courses, and spilling lines for the topsails, to say nothing of new sheets and clewlins fore and aft. Then again all hands had rounded the horn at least once, some many times, and they took their long woollen drawers, their mittens, and their Magellan jackets very seriously when they were served out, while most of those who had had any foresight dug into their chests for Monmouth caps, Welsh wigs, or padded domes with flaps, to protect the wearer's ears and strings to tie beneath his chin. This serving out happened on a Tuesday in fine clear weather, a pleasant to gallant breeze blowing from the northwest, and it seemed almost absurd. On Friday the ship was tearing eastwards, with four men at the wheel, snow blurring both binnacles, hatches battened down, and the muffled watch on deck sheltering in the waist, dreading a call to grapple with the frozen rigging and bored stiff sails. Presently, in this incessant roar of sea and wind, and in this continual tension, the vision of the warm and mild Pacific faded, leaving little evidence apart from Stephen's collections, neatly labelled, noted, and wrapped in oiled silk and then sailcloth, carefully packed into thoroughly watertight casks set up by the cooper, and stowed in the hold, and apart from the remarkable store of provisions Mr. Adams had laid in. He had had a free hand. He was not bound by the pinch-penny rules of the King's service, since in her present state the Surprise was run on the privateer's tradition of the ship's own money, a personal reserve to be laid out in marine stores, food and drink, a stated share of all the prizes, a very handsome sum after the sale of the Franklin, the Alastor, and the Whalers, and she was sailing eastwards deep laden with provisions of the highest quality, enough to last another circumnavigation. This was just as well, for after a few days of the first icy blow, when the deathly chill had worked right into the whole ship from keelson to cabin, all hands began to eat with far more than usual eagerness. Their hunger persisted, since the roaring westerly storm had sent the ship a great way at great speed, south and east into the high 50s, a cold region at the best, and now even colder in this unusual year, even without a wind. Frequent rain, even more frequent sleet and snow, most hands wet most of the time, all of them always cold. In such very thick weather observation was impossible for days on end, and in spite of his chronometers and well-worn sextant, and of the presence of three other expert navigators aboard, Jack could not be sure of his longitude or latitude, dead reckoning in such wind and seas being wonderfully uncertain. He therefore reduced sail, and the frigate moved eastwards at an average of no more than 3 knots, sometimes under bare poles, or with a mere scrap of sail right forward to give her steerage way when the wind blew a full gale from the west. Yet there were also those strange Antarctic calms, when the albatrosses, and half a dozen followed the Surprise, together with some Cape pigeons and most of the smaller petrels, sat on the heaving sea, unwilling or unable to rise. And during two of these the drum beat to quarters, as it had done all the way south from Valparaiso, and the gun crew exercised their pieces, housing them warm, dry and new-charged, with a touch-hole covered and the Tompkins doubly waterproofed with grease, ready for instant service. It was after the second of these exercises, two fine, rippling broadsides, almost up to the old Surprise's astonishing accuracy and speed, that the sky cleared, and Jack had a series of perfect observations of first the Sun, then Achenar, and later Mars himself, positions that were confirmed by the other officers and that showed that in spite of this dawdling, their initial zeal had brought them almost to the rendezvous far too soon. The China ships intended to pass south of Diego Ramirez with the full moon, and in her present stage she was only 3 days old. That would mean a great deal of beating to and fro in the most inhospitable seas known to man, with no more than a passable likelihood of success after all. Quite apart from the unpredictable winds, foul weather or fair, state of the sea and so on, merchantmen on such a voyage never attempted any great accuracy of movement.
"We shall have to stand off and on until well past the full," said Jack at supper.
Fish soup, a dish of sweetbreads, Peruvian cheese, 2 bottles of Coquimbo claret.
"The full of the moon, of course."
"An uninviting prospect," said Stephen. "Last night I was unable to control my cello because of the erratic jerking of the floor, and this evening most of my soup is spread on my lap, while day after day men are brought below with cruel bruises, even broken bones, and are falling from the frozen ropes above or slipping on the icy deck below. Do you not think it would be better to go home?"
"Yes, it often occurs to me, but then my innate nobility of character cries out, 'Hey, Jack Aubrey, you mind your duty, do you hear me there? Do you know about duty, Stephen?'"
"I believe I have heard it well spoken of."
"Well, it exists, and apart from the obvious duty of distressing the king's enemies, not that I have anything against Americans, they are capital seamen, and they treated us most handsomely in Boston, but it is my duty. Apart from that, I say, we also have a duty to the officers and the foremast jacks. They have brought the barkey here in the hope of 3 China ships, and if I call out, 'Oh, be damned to your 3 China ships, what will they say? They are not man-of-war's men, and even if they were—"
Stephen nodded. The argument was unanswerable, but he was not quite satisfied.
"As I was stuffing a green Andean parakeet this afternoon," he said, "another thought came to me. As you say, the Americans are capital seamen. They beat us hollow in the Java and carried us prisoners away. Do you not feel that attacking 3 of their China ships is somewhat rash? Does it not smack of that pride which goeth before destruction?"
"Oh dear, no, these are not solid great Indiamen. These are not 1,000-ton companies' ships that you could take for men of war, nor anything like it. They are quite modest private merchantmen with a few 6-pounders and swivels and small arms, just to beat off the pirates of the South China Sea. They have nothing like the very heavy crew of a man of war, above all an American man of war, and they could not fire a full broadside even if they carried the guns, which they don't. No, in the unlikely event of their keeping all together and manoeuvring just so, they must still fall victims to even a quite small frigate capable of firing 3 well-directed 144-pound broadsides in under 5 minutes."
"Well," said Stephen. And then, "if we must wait for your more or less mythical Chinaman, if we must wait until your sense of duty is satisfied, may we not go just a little way south, just to the edge of the ice? How charming that would be."
"With all due respect, Stephen, I must tell you that I utterly decline to go anywhere near any ice whatsoever, however thin, however deeply laden with seals, great auks, or other wonders of the deep. I hate and despise ice. Ever since our mortal time with the Ice Island in the horrible old Leopard, I've always sworn never to give it any countenance."
"My dear," said Stephen, pouring him another glass of wine, "how well a graceful timidity does become you."
Stephen Maturin had little room to prate about timidity. In the relatively tranquil forenoon watch of the following day, Captain Aubrey caused a crow's nest in the whaler's manner to be set up on the main topmast head, a crow's nest stuffed with straw so that the lookout should not freeze to death. Dr. Maturin, having publicly expressed a wish to see farther to the south in case, on this clear day, ice might be visible, Jack, in the presence of his officers and several hands, invited him to take a view from this eminence. Stephen looked at the masts. The ship was rolling 21 degrees and pitching 12, and blenched. But he lacked the moral courage to refuse, and within minutes he was rising through the maze of rigging, rising on a double whip with several turns about his person and a look of contained horror on his face. Bondon and young Weddle steered him through the shrouds and backstays and their reinforcements. Jack preceded him by foot, and between them they got him safe into the nest.
"Now I come to think of it," said Jack, who had meant no harm at all, "I do not believe you have ever been aloft with a ship a little skittish. I hope it don't make you uneasy."
"Not at all," said Stephen,
glancing over the edge at the absurdly distant, white-streaked sea immediately below on the starboard roll, and closing his eyes again.
"I like it, of all things."
"I am afraid you will not see much in the south," said Jack.
He pointed his telescope and kept it fixed, while the mast upon which he was poised went through its gyrations, swinging his pigtail left and then right and then straight out behind. Watching it as he lay there, coiled in the straw, Stephen asked,
"How much do you suppose we move at all?"
"Well," said Jack, still sweeping the southern rim of the world, "we are rolling about 20 degrees and pitching, let us say, 12, so at this height the roll should carry us some 75 feet and the pitch 45, and we describe a tolerably angular ellipse. You sure it don't worry you?"
"Never in life," said Stephen,
bringing himself to look over the edge again. And having looked,
"Tell me, brother, do people ever come this way voluntarily? I mean, apart from those that ply up and down the American coast?"
"Oh, yes. With the steady westerlies and the west wind drift, this is the quickest way from New South Wales to the Cape. Oh, dear me, yes. They began using it at the very beginning of the infernal colony, you remember, and the Navy still. I tell you what, Stephen, there is something very nasty blowing up in the south. The swell is already with us, and I fear a deadly storm. Bondon! Bondon there! Clap onto the line! I'm sending the doctor down! Bear a hand! Bear a hand!"
It was a cruel, hard blow, and the Surprise clawed off from Diego Ramirez and its long tail of rocks as far and fast as ever she could, sometimes making fair headway, sometimes lying to under storm trysails when the prodigious southern swell compelled her to do so, but always keeping enough sea room for the comfort of those aboard, every man Jack of whom dreaded a lee shore more than anything in this world, and perhaps the next. That, however, was the only kind of comfort they knew until at last the storm blew itself out. For the rest of the time the ship was in very violent motion, with green seas sweeping her deck fore and aft, nobody turning in dry, nobody lying warm, nobody having a hot meal and rarely a hot drink, all hands called night after night. Yet the storm did blow itself out. The strong westerlies returned, and the frigate made her uneven way back across the southern swell cut into frightful seas by a strong sideways blast. Most very strong irregular winds have freakish effects, and this was no exception. No men were lost or seriously injured, but on the other hand, the well-lashed and double-griped spare top and t'gallant masts on the leeward side of the booms flew overboard, together with other valuable spars, like a bundle of twigs, while the doctor's skiff, stowed inside the untouched launch, was utterly destroyed. And while the doctor himself, contemplating the apocalyptic scene from a scuttle in the cabin, he was not allowed on deck, saw a sight unique in his experience, an albatross, navigating the great crests and troughs with all its natural skill, was surprised by a flying packet of water plucked from a cross-current and dashed into the sea. It arose from the boil with an enormous wing-stroke and fled across the face of the rising wave. No sound could, of course, be heard, but Stephen thought he detected a look of extreme indignation on its face. They were back on their station, with the islands clear on the larboard beam except in thick weather. But they had brought the cold with them, the right Antarctic cold of the high 60s and beyond, and although the midshipman's berth took a perverse delight in fishing up pieces of drift ice to freeze their already frigid grog, the older hands, particularly those who had sailed in South Sea whalers, looked upon it with sullen disapproval as a mark of worse, far worse, to come. This cold, and this for late summer unparalleled show of ice, meant that whenever the westerlies paused, which they sometimes did, without any rhyme or reason that could be made out, the air was filled with mist, or even downright fog. They paused indeed in the middle watch of the Friday after the ship's return, the day after the full moon, and presently they were succeeded by an air from the north. This strengthened with the rising of the sun, and immediately after breakfast the man in the crow's nest hailed the deck in an enormous voice of passionate intensity.
"Sail ho! 2 sailor ships on the larboard bow!"
The hail reached the cabin, where Jack was drinking coffee in a battered half-pint mug and eating eggs. He had already started up, thrusting both from him, when Reed darted in, crying,
"2 sailor ships, sir, fine on the larboard bow!"
Jack ran aloft, straight up, without a pause, the hoar frost scattering from the ratlins under his feet. The lookout moved down onto the yard to leave him room, calling up,
"They've just cleared the middle island, sir, topsails and courses, which you saw them clear before the fog closed in."
Time passed. The intently listening silence on deck was broken by 2 bells. No one heard the steady heave of the southwestern swell at all. In these latitudes a sea fog could resist almost any amount of wind, being bred from the surface itself. Yet the wind could tear gaps in it, and the wind did so, just as the cold was beginning to pinch Jack Aubrey's nose and ears. 3 miles to the northeast he saw the two ships, their sails white against the black islands of Diego Ramirez. 300 to 400 tons, bluff-bowed, broad in the beam. Stout merchantmen, no doubt, capable of cramming a great deal into their hold, but surely very, very slow. With his glass to his good eye, he studied the nearest. She seemed to be getting ready to change course, bringing the wind onto her quarter in order to sail westward round the southern shore of the last island in the group, before hauling her wind and steering as near north into the Pacific as the breeze would allow. Both her watches were on deck, of course, a meagre crew, and with so few hands no brisk manoeuvre could be expected, yet even so she seemed strangely hesitant about this sensible, straightforward operation. And all at once it occurred to Jack that she was the leader, the ship which had been there before, which pointed out the way, and that she was finding it very difficult to induce her second astern to take notice of her signals. Admittedly, the second astern was more often blurred by fog than not, and in this light flags were difficult to read. His theory was confirmed almost at once. The leading ship fired a gun, and all her people stared eagerly astern to see what effect it would have. She seemed to be keeping no lookout at all. In any case, he was morally certain that she had not seen the surprise. The frigate, lying with reefed courses against a blurred grey background, would have been very hard to see in any case, and to those who had no notion of any enemy within 5,000 miles, she was virtually invisible. The China ship's intention was perfectly obvious, and if the surprise ran a little way to the east and then steered north, she would have the weather gauge, which would enable her to bring them to action when she pleased. Yet he would not hurry things. There was the possibility of the third ship, and as they had been as regular as the Bath to London stagecoach as far as time was concerned, there seemed a strong likelihood that they would be equally exact in number, and it would be a sad shame not to bag the whole shooting match. The third ship must be allowed to sail right through the tangled islands and join her companions, for once she was in the open sea there was no return with this breeze. Very soon the wind would back into the west, and with the surprise's remarkable powers of sailing close-hauled, the merchantman could not hope to escape. He leaned over the edge of the crow's nest, and in a quiet voice he called,
"Captain Pullings!"
"Sir?"
"Pray let all hands go to quarters, but without any noise at all, no drum! And as soon as the fog closes in on us, make sail. All plain sail, course north-northeast. For the moment let Mr. Norton go into the mizzen-top with a glass and bonden to the fore."
The muffled sound of many feet below. Guns run out with infinite precaution, no more than the faint squeak of a truck, the inevitable but stifled clash of round shot. Then the fog closed in, and without a single order, the sails dropped from their yards or rose silently along their stays. The frigate gathered way. Pullings could be heard saying,
"Thus, thus, very well thus,"
to the helmsman as she settled on her course. 3 bells.
"Bow's that goddamn bell!"
said Jack, rather loud. 15 minutes more, and as he had expected, the breeze freshened, backing westward. He felt a sudden chill waft about him, and he was not alone, for the whalers looked at one another with a meaning nod.
"Sir," called Bondon, "2 sailor ships on the larboard beam." "No, a brig and a ship."
"Where away?"
asked Jack. His injured eye was now watering extremely in the icy breeze, blurring the sight of both.
"Which I've lost them now, sir," said Bondon. "The ships seemed a fair size, topsails and I think forecourse, but they come and go. Sometimes you would say a ship of the line, sometimes only a sloop."
Silence. Blankness. Grey trails of mist wafted through the rigging, leaving ice crystals on every strand. Jack whipped a handkerchief over his poor eye, and he was still knotting the ends when an eddy tore something of a window in the fog. The China ships, all 3 of them now, could be seen quite plain. They had cleared the islands and they were well to the south of them, exactly where reason had foretold, but illogically the newcomers, though closer too, indeed between the surprise and her quarry, were much vaguer, mere looming shapes. Yet they were clear enough for Awkward Davies to bawl out,
"Now there are 5 of the poor unfortunate buggers! 5!
In an exulting roar, instantly suppressed, and Jack had a fleeting glimpse of gun ports on the large vessel before they both merged in the greyness once more, slightly darker forms that soon vanished entirely. There followed a long period of total uncertainty, with the fog thickening, clearing, thickening again, and both lookouts confusing the object they reported, sometimes taking the brig for the ship, or the other way about. The two vessels were moving quite fast in relation to one another, while even the experienced Bonden varied strangely about their size. Jack saw virtually nothing. It seemed to him that these were almost certainly Spaniards, merchantmen bound for Valparaiso and to the northward. The larger one, if she was really as large as she sometimes seemed to be, 1,000 tons and more, possibly for the Philippines. The row of gunports was neither here nor there. Even if they were real, that did not mean there were any guns behind them. Most merchantmen had a full array, real or painted, as some sort of a deterrent.
"Sail ho! Sail on the starboard bow, sir!" called Norton.
Jack whipped round, saw the towering whiteness loom through the mist, thinning over there, and heard Norton cry,
oh no, sir, I'm sorry, it's an ice island!"
Yes, and there was another beyond it, with more appearing in the south and the east as the fog grew patchy, and now the particular chill of a breeze blowing off ice was far more pronounced. By this time, the Surprise was perfectly well placed for her attack on the China ships. They were well beyond the islands, moving steadily a little south of west, and with the present breeze she could cross their wake under a moderate press of sail within an hour or so. The misty newcomers lay between the Surprise and her prey. She would probably pass within hail, and as he contemplated those vague forms, now remarkably large and even doubled by the odd reflection from frozen mist particles, coupled with what dim shadows they were capable of casting, it occurred to him that the ship might conceivably be a Spanish man-of-war sent to deal with the Alastor, news of her depredation having reached Cadiz.
"If that is the case," he reflected, "I shall ask Stephen to have a civil word with her."
He leant over, meaning to tell Pullings to wear the ship round onto her new westward course, but even as he gathered his breath, he heard that never-to-be-forgotten sound of falling ice, as a mass the size of a parish church broke from the nearest island and plunged 100 feet into the sea, sending up an immense turmoil of spray and leaping water. And he changed the order to that for tacking, a quicker operation altogether, though much less economical in wear and tear and effort.
"The sooner we are out of this, the better," he reflected,
glancing astern at the huge forms moving steadily northwards through the fog, although they were already much further to the north than they had any right to be at this time of the year. The ship was round on her new tack and gathering way. All had been coiled down and hands were laying out on the fore-topgallant yards when the brig showed dim on the larboard beam, then plainer and plainer.
"The brig ahoy!"
hailed Jack in his powerful voice, now from the quarter-deck. No reply, but in the rapidly clearing air a great deal of activity could be made out.
"Colours,"
said Jack to Reed, the signal midshipman. And then louder, very much louder, as the colours broke out,
"What ship is that? Que barco esta?"
"Nowhere's Ark, 10 days out of Ararat, New Jersey," replied the brig, with a cackle of maniac laughter.
Her big fore and aft mainsail was hauled right aft, she heeled violently to leeward, her stern chaser went off, sending a ball through the Surprise's forestaysail, and she vanished into the mist. The Surprise replied at random. The crack of the single gun, a forecastle carronade, was still echoing to and fro between the curtains of fog, when a second dark form heaved up on the starboard bow, grew rapidly distinct, and lit the remaining mist between them with a thundering broadside, 18 crimson flashes. The guns had been fired on the downward roll, and most of the shot fell short, but some hit the Surprise by ricochet, breaking through the hammocks in the netting and rolling across the deck. 18-pound round shot. The smoke swept to leeward, much of the mist with it, and clear and plain Jack saw a heavy American frigate, a 38-gun ship with a 342-pounds broadside, apart from her chasers and carronades. The Surprise was hopelessly outgunned, and with her small privateer's crew hopelessly outmanned, while there was also the brig of war ready to infest her disengaged side or rake her from astern.
"Fire as they bear!" cried Jack.
He bore the helm up, the ship's head fell off from the wind, her starboard guns bore in succession and fired, each with accurate deliberation. She had a surprising amount of way on her, and in a quicker side, Jack said,
"Tom, I'm going to put her about if ever she will stay. Do what you can."
Then aloud,
"Larboard guns, one round as they bear! Sail trimmers away!"
He put the helm over. The good ship responded, turning, turning, turning dead into the wind. If she missed stays, if she fell off, all was lost. She turned yet, turning just beyond the crucial point, with hands madly flatting in forward to help her, filled her jib and head staysails on the other tack, and she was round, and the larboard guns were bearing at point-blank range. The moment the last was fired and made fast, the gun crews all leapt to brace round and to haul aft the sheets that had been let go, and to clear the horrible apparent confusion. Jack gave the course east-northeast, a half-east, hoping to weather the nearest iceberg on his starboard bow, the only way out of this impossible encounter, and as soon as there were a few hands free he called,
"T'gallants and weather stunsails!"
while he and those who could gather together attended to the unloaded guns. Although he was somewhat taken aback by this shockingly improper going about, a manoeuvre that had brought the surprise so close to his larboard bow that quite apart from the terrible effect of her round shot, fragments of glowing wad had come aboard, lighting a spilt cartridge and causing an explosion, the American captain brought his ship round, spreading canvas at an extraordinary rate and steering a parallel course, somewhat to leeward, close-hauled to the strengthening wind, now at northwest. Obviously he had made his turn later than Jack, which set him close on a mile behind and almost as much farther east, yet even so he thought he too might weather the ice island, although it was moving steadily northwards. This particular island, for there were many others in sight, south and east, could now be seen as a whole in the increasing light, full 2 miles across, rising in steep crags and spires, green in general but ice blue in the towering middle regions, and its northwestern point, the point which the Surprise must weather if she were to have any chance of escaping destruction, and the point for which the American was steering with such urgency, ended in a sheer ice cliff, much worn, fretted into pinnacles. To begin with, the American, with his full man-of-war's complement of hands, had been able to spread more canvas in spite of the damage and slaughter of that brief point-blank engagement, and to make up some of the lost distance. But now that the Surprises had set their gun deck in order, they evened the difference, and both ships raced through the frigid sea with everything their masts could bear, bowlines twanging taut, both firing chasers as they ran. Jack left the gunnery to Pullings and Mr. Smith. He stood at the conn, sailing the ship, getting every inch of windward distance out of the wind's thrust, calculating leeway, gazing at the fatal cliff with his good eye, feeling the pain in his heart as the bows and cutwater hit drifting ice, a terribly frequent sound and sometimes very dangerous. He dared not ship a protective bow grace, he could not risk the slightest diminution of the frigate's speed. It was with the horror of a nightmare that he saw the calm, doom-like motion of the ice island. The vast bulk moved with the apparent ease of a cloud, and the slight expanse of safe water to the windward of its tip was narrowing, narrowing every minute.
"Sir," said Wilkins, "the brig has altered course."
Certainly, Jack had expected it. These turns and her own manoeuvres had brought the brig to the westward of both ships, on the Surprise's quarter and somewhat nearer to her than the heavy frigate, and for the last 2 miles she had been losing steadily. Now, in answer to a signal, she was bearing up with the evident intention of crossing the Surprise's stern and raking her, firing a broadside that would run the whole length of the ship. It was a bold move, since Jack had only to make a slight turn to larboard to bring his own broadside to bear and quite possibly sink her. But the time taken by even a slight turn, by the discharge and the falling off again to her true course, would almost certainly make the Surprise lose her race against the iceberg's movement.
"My compliments to Captain Pullings," he said, having looked fore and aft, "and beg he will direct all his attention to the brig's foremast and yard."
The stern chase guns in the cabin below increased their rate of fire. 8 shots in rapid succession, and there was a triumphant roar. Jack turned, saw the brig shoot up into the wind, her square foresail down on deck, her fore and aft mainsail swinging her helplessly out of control. He nodded, but the real essence of the matter lay ahead. Not half a mile ahead. With his good eye he could now gauge his leeway exactly against the long fissure in the ice. It would be a near-run thing, a damned near-run thing. He had the wheel under his hands, easing her very gently to the rise of each swell, urging her a trifle and still another trifle to windward, to the thin lane at the cliff's very foot itself. Not 2 cables now, and they were running at 8 knots. There was no turning back.
"Sir!"
said Wilkins again. "The frigate ports her helm." Again Jack nodded. She had been to the leeward of the Surprise from the beginning. Now she had no chance whatsoever of weathering the point, and she meant to hit the Surprise as hard as ever she could, crippling her before she was out of reach. He shrugged. His course was wholly committed now, and again he eased the helm, his eyes as intent upon the lane of green water as they might have been on a tall hedge with God knows what beyond, and he galloping towards it. He was aware of the whiter surf rising on the white ice at the cliff's foot, of a still whiter albatross crossing the swell, and even before he heard the American's broadside, he was stunned and deafened by the enormous crash of ice falling from the cliff itself. He felt the ship's hull tremble and then grate on the iceberg's submerged outer shelf, and saw the mizzenmast, shot through in two separate places, sway, break, and go slowly over the side.
"Axes! Axes!" he roared. "Cut all away! Cut clear! Cut clear!"
Shrouds, backstays, rigging all whipped free. The ship ran past the ice cliff, her mainyard scraping, past and beyond into the open water. Sea room and to spare for a good 3 miles. Ice islands thick beyond. She answered her helm perfectly. She was an entirely living ship, and there was a prodigious mass of ice between her and the enemy's guns. Jack was aware of some confusion in his mind. Just in what order had things happened? Not that it signified. The ship was swimming in clear water. He sent Reed to ask the carpenter to sound the well and then looked for the destruction here on deck. There was surprisingly little. The mizzen had gone as clean as a whistle, and the boatswain, together with his mates, was knotting and splicing.
"What damage did it do among the people?"
he asked Wilkins.
"None this last bout, sir. The ice missed us by a shaver."
Pullings came aft, smiling, curiously talkative, a marlin spike in his hand.
"Give you joy of our passage, sir," he said. "At one moment I did not think she could do it, and my heart was fairly up in my mouth. And then when the ice came down, I said, 'All up with you, Pullings, old cock.' But, however, it missed."
"You saw what happened?"
"Why, yes, sir. I just put my head over the top of the ladder when the Yankee opened fire. Deliberate shots at first. One hit the mizzen below the hounds. And then when we were weathering the point and running clear, all her remaining guns at once, and some of their shots hit the ice, or perhaps it was just the concussion. Anyway, a thundering great steeple came down. 1,000 ton, I dare say. I never seen the like nor heard it. Plunged into our wake, soaked one and all. And some odd fragments spoilt the gingerbread work on the taffrail."
Jack perceived that he was indeed deeply soaked behind, and perhaps still somewhat shattered by the fantastic uproar. He said,
"How I regret the mizzen. But a moment's attempt at saving it would have brought us right on the ice. As it was, we scraped most horribly, and I tremble for our copper. Yes, Mr. Reed?"
"If you please, sir, Chips says—"
"What was that, Mr. Reed?"
"Beg pardon, sir. Mr. Bentley says 2 inches in the well, no more."
"Very good. Tom, we must put before the wind or close on until we ship a jury mizzen. Pick our oldest whale men and send them into the crow's nest, one after another, to pick us a way through the ice. There is a terrible quantity to leeward. Let a stout bow grace be prepared, since we are not likely to see that big fellow," nodding westwards, "until he has gone about twice, let the galley fires be lit and all hands fed."
"He may consider it his duty to hurry back and protect his convoy," said Pullings.
"Let us hope he has a very strong sense of duty, an overwhelming sense of duty," said Jack.
In fact, the big American did not round the point until well on in the afternoon. The devoted brig had not only lost her yard, shot through in the slings, but had also stopped a 9-pounder ball just under the waterline and sprung abut. Water and pieces of ice were pouring into her. By this time the Surprise, keeping the wind 1 and 2 points on her starboard quarter as far as the ice allowed it, had travelled 10 miles in a straight line. More, of course, when her deviations to avoid icebergs and close-packed ice fields were counted, and it was from this distance, the fog having largely cleared, that at last her lookout saw the big American. Yet she too would have to thread those devious channels and circumvent the same islands, and Jack sat down to his belated dinner with as easy a mind as was compatible with the loss of a mast, the presence of an active and enterprising enemy, and of an unconscionable amount of ice ahead in the form of floating islands or massive floes. He had already been down to the sick berth to see the very moderate casualties. 2 splinter wounds, one of them the invariably unfortunate Joe Place, one man struck into a coma by a falling block, but not despaired of, one man with toes and metatarsals crushed by a recoiling gun, and he had told Stephen that dinner would be ready by 8 bells, adding,
4 o'clock, you know,
in case he did not. He did, however, and at the first stroke he walked eagerly in, wiping his hands.
I am so sorry I have kept you, but I had to take that foot off, after all. Such a massive, comminuted bone. Pray tell me how we do.
Pretty well, I thank you. The American is 10 miles astern, and I do not think he can possibly come within range before nightfall. Allow me to give you a piece of this fish, a cousin to the cod, it seems.
They tell me we have lost a mast. Will this impede our progress to any fatal degree? Will it reduce our pace by, say, a third?
I hope not. When we are sailing large, the mizzen makes surprisingly little difference, and less than you might think, close-hauled. With a side wind, the balance would be upset, and she would fall off sadly. I should not like to be chased by a herring-bus in the open ocean with a strong side wind, but I hope that the westerlies, or south-westerlies, will go on blowing until some lingering notion of responsibility makes the captain of that frigate turn back to his convoy.
I do not believe those ships were his convoy. I believe there was a chance meeting in, say, the River Plate, no more. But it makes little odds, since I am convinced he will protect them now. My dear, you look sadly done up, and your appetite has failed you. Drink up another glass of wine and breathe as deeply as you can. I shall give you a comfortable dose tonight.
No, Stephen, many thanks, but it would not do. I shall not turn in, nor I shall not heave to, neither. I dare not let that cove, a determined and bloody-minded cove if ever there was one, creep up on me in the night. Coffee is more the mark than a dose, however comfortable and kindly intended. Let us toy with these chops. I do love a dry chop, a really well-dried mutton chop, turned twice a day.
The well-dried chops sustained him all that night, which he spent in the crow's nest, kept if not warm, then at least preserved from death by a sequence of whalers, and refreshed every other hour by the truly devoted Killick, or his mate, who came aloft in mittens, holding a villainous tin pot of coffee slung by a loop in their teeth. A fairly clear night, particularly at 10 or 20 feet above the surface, a moderate swell for these parts, and above all the blessed moon, only just past the full and as brilliant as extreme cold could make her. The watch on deck, muffled in their Magellan jackets with flannel shirts over their heads, stood by to shove off floating slabs of ice with what spars the ship still possessed. And so, with the whalers advising what lanes to take, the Surprise groped her way cautiously eastwards and as far north of east as ever she could manage. In spite of the stout bow grace and the zeal of those employed in shoving off, she received some wicked strokes from the thick, deep-swimming floes, and several times the high-perched Jack Aubrey trembled for his nest, literally trembled with extreme cold, weariness, and the grave tension of guiding his ship through this potentially mortal maze. He was no longer a young man. By the strange sunrise he was older still, a sun rising in a clear sky that presently grew light sapphire blue, while the sea took on a deeper tinge and the ice islands showed at some points pure rosy pink, and at others bright ultramarine. But there, at 7 miles or less, considerably farther south, lay the dogged American. In this light her hull looked black, and she had already begun to set more sail. Jack swung over the side of the crow's nest, and as he gripped the topmost shrouds, his frozen hand slipped on the coat of ice. He would have fallen, but that his legs, so long at sea, instantly whipped round the shroud below and held him for the vital moment. On deck he said,
"Tom, when the hands have had their breakfast, let us shake out our reefs and set the foretogallant. Look at that fellow,"
nodding southwards.
"He has stunsails both sides, aloft and alow.
I dare say he has a clear stretch of water for the moment, but I must say the ice field looks right solid down there," said Pullings hopefully, and they both staggered as the Surprise struck yet another heavy floe. There was a hanging stove lit in the cabin, still more coffee, endless eggs and bacon, toast, a creditable Peruvian orange marmalade. Jack, stripped to his waistcoat, absorbed these things and the warmth, but he had little conversation, merely observing that he had seen an albatross, several seals, and a most prodigious whale. Stephen spoke, in a desultory fashion, about ice islands and the sudden change in colour at the point of cleavage when some great mass fell into the sea.
"This I have observed in a telescope," he said,
then paused, for Jack's head was sinking on his breast.
"If you please, sir," cried Reed, bouncing in, alive with youthful joy, "Captain Pulling says, would you like to step on deck?"
"Eh?"
asked Captain Aubrey. Reed said it again, and Jack heaved himself up, all 17 stone. Reed led him blinking aft, passed him a telescope, and said,
"There, sir, directly to windward."
Jack gazed, changed the glass to his good eye, gazed again, his tired face lighting with a great smile. He stamped upon the frozen deck and cried,
"He counted his chickens without his host, by God! Ha ha ha!"
For the big frigate lay motionless, her sails brailed up, and she was getting her boats over the side.
"On deck there!"
hailed the lookout, one of the Surprise's whalemen.
"Sir, she's gone down a lane in the ice field, a blind alley like, a no thoroughfare, ha ha ha, and she'll have to tow back 3 miles into the wind's eye, ha ha ha!"
And in something of an undertone to his mate at the foremast head,
"Oh, won't he cop it, that poor bleeding sod of a lookout of theirs, ha ha!"
The distant ship fired a gun to leeward, sending up a cloud of Antarctic skewers from a dead and drifting whale.
"The enemy has fired a leeward gun, sir, if you please," reported the signal midshipman.
"You astonish me, Mr. Reed," said Jack. "And now I perceive she is throwing out a signal. Be so good as to read it."
Norton stepped forward. Reed rested the telescope on his shoulder, focused, and said,
"Alphabetic, sir. Our alphabet. HAPPYRETURN, sir."
"Come," cried Jack, "that's handsome. Reply, same to you. Who is their president, Tom?"
"Mr. Washington, I believe," said Pullings, after some thought.
"Compliments to Mr. Washington would be too long by far. No, leave it at that, Mr. Reed, and give him a gun in return. Tom," he went on, "let us not crack on at all, but proceed east-northeast at a walking pace until we are out of this infernal ice. Let us not rush upon our doom like a parcel of mad lunatics or gabardine swine. A walking pace, Captain Pullings, and in the afternoon we will start work on a jury mast."
In his happy ease of heart he now went straight to sleep in the warm cabin, never moving until dinner time, when he woke, fresh and clear-headed, aware that the ship had touched no ice for some hours. He took a turn on deck, observed that although the sky was murky in the northeast, the sea was as open as the channel, except far, far to the south, where ice and the reflection of ice could still be seen, with great islands cutting the horizon, and paced the quarter-deck until he heard his steward's shrewish, barely respectful, complaining voice,
"Which the cooks says ain't he ever coming? What with everything going cold, spoilt and ruined?"
After dinner, Jack, Pullings and Mr. Bentley conferred about the jury-mizzen, and now it was found just how grievous the loss of spars in the recent blow had been. Though the ship was heavy with prize goods, such as ambergris and cloth of gold taken from the Alastor, with specie, mostly chests of silver, and with provisions of a quantity and, above all, a quality to make a flagship stare, she had scarcely a stick to call her own.
"After endless lamentations and if-onlys," said Jack as he and Stephen were settling to their music, "it was decided that by using the launch's mast and the rough tree rail we could raise stump enough and gaff enough to spread a tolerable mizzen. Enough, at all events, to sail with the wind ahead at a moderate pace without straining the rudder right off its pintles. And if it ain't elegant, why, be damned to elegance."
"What are pintles?"
"Those right-angled pieces in the front of the rudder that hook into rings, or braces, as we say, at the back of the stern-post, so that the rudder can swing like a door on its hinges."
And when they had finished their piece, a gentle, meditative, anonymous manuscript duet bought at an auction, he said,
"Lord Stephen, when you remember how hot we were after those China ships so short a while ago, and how simple we should have looked if we had taken them with that devilish great 18-pounder frigate and the brig coming down on us with a weather gauge, and when you consider how happy we are now to have come off with a loss of no more than our mizzen, why, it makes you think."
"I do not know that I should go quite so far as that," said Stephen.
"Oh, very well, very well. You may be as satirical as you please, but I think we have come out of it most uncommon well. I, for one, never supposed that tonight we could turn in and sleep in peace."
In peace they slept. Profound peace. the piece of physically exhausted but easy-minded and very well-fed men, at least until the graveyard watch. On the moonlit deck, Wilkins, on being relieved by Granger at 8 bells, said,
"Here you have her. Reefed courses for topsail a trip. Course northeast by north. Captain's orders in the binnacle drawer."
Then, in a conversational tone,
"You may have something of a ducking in an hour or so."
"Yes," said Granger, also looking into the northeast, where low, dark clouds quite hid the sky.
"I dare say we shall. A drop of rain and this precious cold will wake me up. Dear Lord, how fast asleep I was. And warm.
I shall be the same in 2 minutes. It was a right hard day and night."
He paused with one foot on the ladder and said,
"Surely it is uncommon to see lightning in these latitudes."
"Oh, I have known it often enough," said Granger.
"Not so often as between the tropics, but pretty often. Only down here you don't linger on deck, so perhaps it seems much rarer."
4 bells, and it began to snow. The surprise was keeping to her sober 5 knots. 6 bells, and the wind strengthened, growing so changeable that once the ship was almost taken aback. Granger close-reefed the foretopsail, and almost immediately afterwards the sky was covered entirely. No moon, no stars. And without a warning, a violent rain mixed with sleet came hurtling down, so violent and so continued, with water jetting wide from the leeward scuppers and the watch huddled under the break of the quarter-deck, that it was impossible to strike 7 bells. Yet 3:30 in the morning it was. Stephen's watch said so. And as it was telling the hour, so Stephen, for the 2nd time in his life, and in the same ship, was woken by an enormous noise or combination of noises that he instantly recognised. The frigate had surely been struck by lightning. She had indeed. Her mainmast was utterly shattered, its fragments flung into the sea. Its yards, however, lay athwartships, and like the foremast, they were quite untouched. The ship had at once put before the wind whatever the helmsman might do, but as the snow and rain had calmed the sea, she was reasonably steady, though unmanageable, and Stephen was soon called down to the sick berth. There were only 3 casualties. One man, a nipperdolling named Isaac Rame, apparently uninjured apart from a black mark the size of a shilling over his heart, but completely, profoundly insensible. Listening to its completely disordered beat, Stephen shook his head. And 2 other foremast hands strangely burned. These burns, though superficial, caused much distress. They were extensive, branching all over the men's backs in a close-set network of divergent lines, and it took Stephen, Padine, and Fabian so long to dress them that a pale daylight was showing upon the table when Stephen came into the cabin for breakfast.
"Well, here's a pretty go,"
cried Jack.
"Here's a pretty mess. Have a cup of coffee."
Pouring it. He sounded quite cheerful, as though the loss of the ship's mainmast were of slight importance. And so it was, compared with what followed.
"When we have finished breakfast, pray help yourself to bacon and pass the dish, I will show you something more extraordinary by far. Our rudder has gone by the board."
Oh, cried Stephen, aghast. "Are we rudderless, sir?"
"I will not deceive you, brother. We are without a rudder. You remember asking me about Pintles?"
Stephen nodded, still much concerned.
"Well, it appears that at some point in our dreadful passage through the drift ice, a great floe must have lifted the Pintles off the dumb shoulder and the braces, or most of them, and destroyed the woodlocks, so that it was hanging by little more than the tiller. We did not notice it, since we barely touched the helm sailing large, but when the lightning struck the rudder head, shattering all down to the waterline, why, it dropped clean away."
He pointed to the shattered, blackened rudder head, now covered by a decent cloth.
"Is there any help for such a state of affairs?"
"Oh, I am sure we shall find something," said Jack. "May I trouble you for the marmalade? Capital marmalade, you must confess, though not quite as good as Sophie's."
Stephen had often heard Jack say, when life at sea grew more trying than the human frame could bear,
that it was no use whining.
But he had never seen quite this degree of insouciance, or what he felt tempted to call irresponsible levity. How much was assumed as a captain's duty in a virtually hopeless situation? How much was Jack's natural reaction? He was not a man much given to strike attitudes. How hopeless was the situation, in fact? Stephen might still confuse braces and pintles, dumb shoulders and sling dogs, but he knew enough about the sea to feel that a ship, far and far from land, with only 1 mast and no rudder at all, was in a very sad way.
Furthermore, his knowledge of sailing, though limited, did tell him that one mast and its sails in the very front of the ship could impel a rudderless vessel only directly before the wind, that the wind in these latitudes was nearly always westerly, and that there was no land ahead until they came right round the globe to Cape Horn again. He did not like to ask directly, but he put these points to various shipmates. To his distress, they all invariably agreed with him.
"Ah, Doctor, things is very bad," said Joe Place.
"I have never heard anything so dreadful as the loss of a rudder 5,000 miles from land," said Mr. Adams, "for in our condition South America, dead to windward, cannot be considered as land at all." Yet at the same time he detected much of this same cheerfulness throughout the ship, and something not very far from apparent unconcern, even in so atrabilious a soul as Killick.
"Have I been plying the ocean with a parcel of Stoics all this time?" he wondered. "Or in my ignorance am I myself somewhat over timid?"
But then again, in his frequent encounters with the foremast jacks, and his relations with them were of quite a different nature and in some ways much closer than those of any other officer, he had occasional insights that showed an entirely different aspect of the situation, of the moral situation at all events. The lower deck knew perfectly well that Vidal and his closest Nipperdolling connections had smuggled Dutour ashore, and they had become convinced that once ashore, Dutour had in some way informed upon the doctor, putting his life in danger. And it was as though this treachery had brought bad luck on the surprise, however kindly Vidal had meant his action in the first place. Bad luck was a term that embraced a great deal. Other people might have spoken of a curse, a spell, or a divine resentment of impiety. But whatever it was called, they had missed the China ships, and they had been near as a toucher sunk by the Americans, by the ice islands, and by the ice floes. And now the barkie had been struck by lightning. But it was a Nipperdolling that had copped it, and once he went over the side, the bad luck would be off the ship. He went the second day after the stroke. His shipmates attended with real concern. They had nothing against Isaac Rama himself, nothing whatsoever, but when the high southwestern swell closed over him without a splash on Tuesday morning, they went back to their work, with a particular satisfaction, one that informed their entire attitude. This satisfaction continued throughout the week, or rather more. Stephen, who was often, almost invariably, in the way on deck when complex work was being carried out, wrote a commentary on it for Diana. "Mariners, consensus and cohesion in certain states of adversity," together with "some remarks on Peruvian cirripedes" for the Royal Society. For the most part, the weather was kind, the wind, though often boisterous, steady in the west, and although they had frequent rain and two blinding snowstorms, there was no ice about, and the temperature was nearly always above freezing by day. They were still without a rudder, but until one could be fashioned, and above all hung, they had a steering oar over the quarter that allowed a point or two of northerly deviation from their steady eastward course. By the end of this time, three sad little poles rose from where the stately masts had been, the foremast standing stark alone, its topmast and t'gallant, both worked into the launch's mast, stood for the shattered main, and an even stranger assembly took the place of the mizzen, spreading a pitiful fore and aft sail the size of the cabin tablecloth. Yet it did give a certain balance. From the main and the foreyards hung broad but extraordinarily shallow square sails, so low that when Stephen was led on deck to see them, he asked where they were intended to be hoisted.
"They are hoisted," he was told, in a voice of strong displeasure.
Forward still, and there was the unhurt bowsprit, carrying its spritsail and spritsail topsail. And since the ship was very well found in bosun's and sailmaker's stores, she wore all the staysails that could possibly be managed.
"It is just like Bridie Coleman's washing day, I do declare," said Stephen, in another unfortunate attempt to please. "Everything is within an easy hand's reach, so it is." "This is an extraordinarily small piece of plum duff," he observed at dinner, Sunday dinner, in the cabin. "I wish it may not be an ignoble stroke of revenge for my innocent words this morning about our harmless, meek, and barge-like appearance. Innocent, upon my word, and even, I thought, amusing, a mild pleasantry. But not at all. Prim faces, wry looks, and now this meagre, despicable pudding. I had thought better of my shipmates."
"You mistake, brother," said Jack. "Mr. Adams and I, in our joint character as purser, cast our accounts yesterday,
reckoning every last firkin of oatmeal, every bin and locker in the breadroom, and dividing the whole, private stores not excepted, by the number of mouths aboard. That piece of pudding is your full ration, my poor Stephen."
"Oh, indeed," said Stephen, looking rather blank.
"Yes. I have told the ship's company of this, and I have told them that unless or until we can fashion and ship a rudder—"
"If you spend another 2 minutes up to your neck in water at this temperature striving to do so, I will not answer for your life," said Stephen. "Last time it was nip and tuck, with hot blanket, fermentations, and half a pint of my best brandy."
"Unless we can ship a rudder that will enable us to haul up for St. Helena, I intend to bear away for the Cape, edging north all the time with our steering oar, or perhaps some better gear. It is about 3,500 miles, and although we have logged over 100 for each of these last 3 days with this comic rig, as you so rightly call it, and with this steady wind and beautiful eastward current, I have only reckoned on 50, no more. 1/70th part of the distance. 50 multiplied by 70 is 3,500, Stephen. And that succulent, luxurious pudding now in front of you is the 70th part of all the duff that you will eat before we raise the Table Mountain."
"God love you, Jack, what things you tell me."
"Never despond, dear Stephen. Remember that Bligh sailed 4,000 miles in an open boat with not 1/1000th part of our stores." "You will never despond, Stephen," said Jack, with very slight emphasis. "And I am sure you will never find any of the seamen do so either."
"No," said Stephen, stifling his recollections of the terrible following seas during the frequent storms in these latitudes, the perpetual danger of being pooped, of broaching to, and of being lost with all hands in a turmoil of foam. "No, I shall not despond."
"And, Stephen, may I beg you not to be facetious when speaking of the barkie? The people are surprisingly susceptible, if you know what I mean, about her appearance. And if ever you intend to be complimentary, you might well be advised just to throw up your hands and cry, 'Oh,' or 'Superb,' or 'I have never seen anything better,' without being particular."
"The doctor has been choked off for being a satyr," said Killick to Grimble.
"What's a satyr?"
"What an ignorant cove you are, to be sure," asked Grimble. "Just ignorant is all. A satyr is a party that talks sarcastic. Choked off something cruel he was, and his duff taken away and eaten before his eyes."
Although the ship was wonderfully busy, the news spread forward with its usual speed, and Stephen, making his way to the forecastle to watch albatrosses and the nondescript petrel that had been following the ship for some days, was greeted with particular kindness, brought a coil of soft manila to sit upon, given a pair of belaying pins to hold his telescope steady, and told about the birds that had been seen that day, including a numerous band of stinkpots flying south, an infallible sign of clear weather. This was all very much in line with what he had so often known at sea, and once more the evident goodwill warmed his spirit. He thought of it with pleasure as he went to sleep, and its absence the next day, together with a want of that cheerfulness so usual on deck, struck him with all the more force when he took the air in the forenoon after a trying, anxious time with a sick berth, when neither Burns nor Foot were doing well, and with his collections, where a vile moth was breeding among the feathers, and no pepper left in the entire ship to discourage it. He arrived on deck not by climbing the companion ladder to the quarter-deck in the usual way, but by the fore hatchway, having traversed the berth deck to consider Dutor's former cabin for the amputation in case his suspicion of an incipient pneumonia, that frequent sequel, should prove to be true. This brought him into the waist of the ship, filled with hands. They touched their hats and wished him good day, but mechanically, with barely a smile, and returned to their low, anxious, intent conversations, frequently calling up in subdued voices to their companion thick along the starboard gangway. He pushed through to the quarter-deck, and there were the same grave faces, grey with cold and discouragement, looking fixedly to windward, that is to say a little south of the ship's modest wake.
"What is afoot?"
he murmured in Reed's ear.
"Stand over here, sir," said Reed, guiding him to the rail, "and look out to windward."
A topsail schooner sailing large, and some miles beyond her a ship, also standing north-northeast, with t'gallants and stunsails aboard, a glorious sight, but one that gave no pleasure.
"It is that brutal great American, come to snap us up," said Reed.
"Shame on him, after such a handsome message," murmured Weddle.
"Where is the captain?"
"Aloft, sir."
"But," Reed whispered, "he don't see very well today. Both eyes water so in the cold."
"It is cold, sure," said Stephen. He focused his best newly cleaned glass, a superlative piece made for him by Dolland, with a somewhat greater magnification than was usual in the Navy for identifying birds, and presently he said, "Tell me, Mr. Reed, frigates have but one row of guns, have they not?" "Yes, sir, just one," said Reed patiently, holding up a single finger. "Well, this boat or vessel has two, as well as some each end." "Nay, sir," said Reed, shaking his head. Then, urgently, "Please, may I have a look?"
"Oh, sir," he shrieked to Pullings at the taffrail, "she ain't the Yankee. She's a two-decker, a 64-gun ship. The doctor saw her."
"On deck there," came Jack's voice from on high, cutting through the unworthy hubbub. "She's a 64-gun ship. The old Berenice, I think. Yes, the old Berenice from the New South Wales station. Berenice too," he added, with a private chuckle.
"And that, much nearer to us," said Stephen to the ecstatic Reed, "is what we at sea term a schooner. But you need not be afraid. She carries little in the way of guns."
"A Baltimore clipper, sir, I believe," said Mr. Adams.
"Indeed. I could have sworn she was a schooner, in spite of those rectangular sails in front."
"Certainly, sir. She is certainly a schooner in rig. The clipper part refers to her hull."
"Oh, she has a hull as well, has she? I was not aware. But pray tell me, Mr. Adams, do you think you could find a little small bag of pepper, just half a stone or so, in the captain's storeroom itself?"
"Sir, I've searched it through and through, in spite of that wicked Killick, and see, she is rounding too."
The schooner checked her way, and a tall young midshipman standing on her low rail and holding a shroud hailed,
"The ship ahoy, if ship you can be called, poor hulk!"
This in an undertone.
"What ship is that?"
"His Majesty's hired vessel Surprise," replied Tom. "Captain Pullings."
All along her side the schooner's hands stood grinning, staring, making offensive gestures. The Surprises looked back with stony hatred.
"Come aboard with your papers," said the midshipman.
"Take that American contraption back to the Berenice," roared Jack, halfway down the ratlins. "And tell Captain Dundas, with Captain Aubrey's compliments, that he will wait upon him. Do you hear me there?"
"Yes, sir," replied the midshipman.
And on either side of him the simpering stopped dead.
"Aye, aye, sir. Captain Aubrey's compliments. Sir,"
he called across the widening lane,
"may I say Philip Aubrey is aboard?"
Oh, the mirth aboard the Surprise. Several of the younger men leapt into the rigging, ostentatiously slapping their buttocks at the schooner as she fled away, sailing unbelievably close to the wind. But many more of the hands gathered in the waist or on the forecastle, oblivious of the cold, revelling in their prize money preserved, even as it were, restored, laughing, clapping one another on the back.
The ships drew near. Nearer.
"I know perfectly well what he is going to say," murmured Jack to Stephen, as they stood there in their boat cloaks by the gangway stanchions.
"He is going to call out, 'Well, Jack, whom the Lord loveth, he chastiseth,' and all his people will set up a silly cackle. There's Philip. Lord, how you shot up!"
Philip was Jack Aubrey's half-brother, last seen as a youngster aboard Dundas's previous command. The Surprise, with her frail spars, could not easily get her launch over the side, and Dundas was sending his barge for them.
It was lowered down in a seamanlike manner, and as it was shoved off, Captain Dundas, waving his hat from the Berenice's quarterdeck, called,
"Well, Jack, whom the Lord loveth, he chastiseth! Ha ha ha! You must be a prime favourite up above! Heavens, you are in a horrid state!"
"Captain Dundas, sir," cried Stephen, "do you think you could oblige me with a few pounds of fresh black pepper?"
The reply was lost as Jack's boatswain and his mates piped their captain over the side. A howling repeated 3 minutes later as the Berenice piped him aboard. Stephen, Pullings, and Philip withdrew from their splendid dinner quite early, Stephen carrying his pepper, and Jack said,
"Old hen, what a pleasant young fellow you have made of Philip. I am so grateful."
"Not at all," said Dundas. "He might have been born to the sea. Cobble says he will rate him master's mate in Hyperion next year, if you would like it."
"I should like it very much indeed. It is time he was out of leading strings. though yours, I am sure, were the kindest in the world."
They sat comfortably together, very old friends and shipmates, sipping their port, pushing the decanter to and fro. Dundas told the servants to turn in, and presently he said,
"You have had a rough time of it, Jack, and so I think has Maturin."
"Yes, I have. Pretty rough. And he has, too. Then again, we have both been away a terrible long time, you know, with very little news, and that adds to the ordinary battering of a distant voyage. Not that it was so ordinary on this occasion. Tell me, how are things at home?"
"I was at Ashgrove last July, and they were all blooming. Sophie in splendid looks. Her mother is living there with a friend, a Mrs. Morris. Children very well indeed, and the girls so pretty, modest and kind. Well, fairly modest and very kind. I did not see Diana, though her horses do famously. She was in Ireland during my short leave. But when I called, I did see Clarissa Oakes, poor young Oakes's widow, who lives there. What a fine young woman she is."
He paused again, then brightened and went on,
"But tell me as far as you can, because Melville let me understand that there was something confidential about your voyage."
Melville, or more formally Lord Melville, was Heneage Dundas's elder brother and First Lord of the Admiralty.
"As far as you properly can. Then how your enterprise went."
"Well, I gathered that the first part in the East Indies went well for Stephen. At least the French were discomfited. But I flung the Diane on a reef in the South China Sea, a total loss. And then in this second bout, now ending, thanks be, we did take a fair number of prizes to begin with, and we destroyed a truly odious pirate. But then I contrived to lose 3 American China ships. Heavens, such wealth! It is true they were protected by a brig and a 38-gun frigate that nearly destroyed us. Oh, hen, such wicked ice south of Diego Ramirez, and north, for that matter. We escaped, true enough, but even so I cannot call the enterprise anything but a failure, and I am very much afraid that Stephen was betrayed, that his plan did not come to good, and that it went right to his heart."
"I will fetch some brandy," said Heneage.
They drank it, staring at the embers in the hanging stove, and when they had settled what masts and spars the Berenice could give the Surprise, with a long aside about Dundas's tender, the Baltimore Clipper, picked up perfect but empty, not a soul, not a scrap of paper, in the South Pacific, and her extraordinary sailing qualities, Jack said,
"No, harking back to this voyage, I think it was a failure upon the whole, and a costly failure. But," he said, laughing with joy at the thought, "I am so happy to be homeward bound, and I am so happy, so very happy to be alive."
This concludes the reading of The Wine-Dark Sea by Patrick O'Brien. Copyright 1993 by Patrick O'Brien. This book was read by Simon Vance.